Welcome to Media Law and Ethics, a podcast series from the School of Communication at Radford University. I'm Professor Bill Koberik, and I'm serving as your guide through this course. This is the fifth in our podcast series out of 10 for the course, and today we're talking about privacy and the media. Now, privacy is a right that's been recognized only recently in the 20th century. It's not one that goes back to, say, the Magna Carta or the dawn of English common law. Privacy laws are an attempt to distinguish between the public sphere of life and the private or personal sphere. Privacy rights involve both personal rights, such as the right to a good reputation, and property rights, such as the right to avoid trespass or to control the way your own picture is used by others for advertising. The history is kind of interesting. The call for privacy laws in the U.S. came from an 1890 Harvard Law Review article by Louis Brandeis, the same Brandeis who later became a U.S. Supreme Court judge. Brandeis noted that England and France had a variety of laws protecting privacy, and he thought the U.S. should adopt similar laws. And he argued that a right to privacy wouldn't prohibit the publication of matters in the public interest, but rather should protect private people from becoming victims of journalistic enterprise. Although truth would be a defense in libel, Brandeis wrote, truth or falsehood was not the issue in this case. The right of privacy implies the right not merely to prevent inaccurate portrayal of private life, but to prevent its being depicted at all. Well, the privacy principle was already part of common law, he argued, but it had become more urgent with the intrusiveness of the yellow press and the arrival of new technology. Now, an example of the way new technologies were challenging the law at this time, around the turn of the 20th century, involved the 1902 case, Roberson versus Rochester Folding Box Company. Printing photographs had only recently become possible with a new halftone process, and so the box company had used a picture of a woman named Abby Robinson on advertising for baking flour without her permission. She was not a public person. She was just a private person that they happened to find a photo of and they liked it. So in the lawsuit, the family claimed the incident caused Mrs. Roberson severe embarrassment and humiliation. But according to the New York Court of Appeals, there was really no law against using her likeness in advertising. So outrage over the case led to the passage of new laws in many states. And a similar sort of case occurred 2 years later in Georgia. And in that case, a right of privacy was found by the courts. More of the kind of protection Brandeis sought for private people began to emerge in state laws with the increasing concern for personal rights in the 1960s. For example, there was a Connecticut case in which distribution of contraceptive information by a doctor to a married couple was seen as protected by the couple's privacy rights. A similar right to privacy was found a few years later in Roe versus Wade. These cases are not media related, so we won't go into them here except to note that they're pretty controversial and, you know, refer you to other areas of privacy law. It's important to note that the courts have generally interpreted privacy law very strictly in terms of the media. That is to say, they've leaned towards defending the freedom of the news media to publish information of public importance. Even in cases where private people are thrust against their will into the public spotlight, such as in the Howard case and the Sipple case, which we'll talk about in a second, invasion of privacy suits are often decided in favor of the news media. This doesn't mean that what is legal is the same thing as what is ethical. And it's a very important point to make here. Under the SPJ and PRSA Code of Ethics, respect for privacy is an important element of ethical behavior. And in advertising, a lack of respect for privacy, especially misappropriation in this sense, can be very expensive and quite illegal. So let's talk about the kinds of invasions of privacy that we mean here, because it's really kind of a broader issue than just mere trespass. Privacy issues are usually considered in four areas under a list that was developed by Professor William Prosser around 1960. They're usually false light, misappropriation, intrusion, and the publication of private facts. And let's go through those in turn. False light is a lot like libel, although it covers instances where there's no defamation involved or where there's proximate photos that imply defamation but are not necessarily identifying the individual. We'll talk about that in a second, too. Usually, in these cases, the Sullivan standard will apply. Actual malice in any event will apply. So in misappropriation of a person's name or likeness or picture, that's often compared to copyright or intellectual property cases. For private people, misappropriation might be called commercialization. For celebrities, misappropriation cases involve what's called a right of publicity. In intrusion, a person's right to seclusion and personal privacy can be violated by the physical presence of the news media. The obvious and most famous case of this is Princess Diana, who was fleeing from the photographers, the paparazzi, when her car ran into a wall under a bridge in Paris and she was killed. So the news media's intrusion has been a frequent cause of loud complaints by celebrities, and there have been a lot of lawsuits about that. Publication of private facts is another area where the news media can run into trouble. For instance, through the unreasonable or objectionable revelation of private facts that may very well be true, but nevertheless embarrassing to private people. Sometimes, in various states, this could be covered by a statute like the one in Virginia for intentional infliction of emotional distress that came up so strongly in the Falwell versus Flint case that we've discussed in the libel chapter. Let's talk a little bit about false light. So we'll take these one at a time again and go into more detail with some of the cases. In terms of false light, that's kind of a close cousin to libel, and it often involves statements that would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. It also usually involves the Sullivan test for actual malice. So there's been a couple of these that have been somewhat interesting. In terms of the People's Bank and Nellie Mitchell versus Globe Publishing, you get an idea of what this is really all about. There were photos of an elderly woman that ran in the National Examiner in 1980, and these were accurately positioned next to a story about the woman's 50 years of service delivering newspapers. And Nellie Mitchell didn't object, and everybody thought it was great. She was kind of an elderly person who was still very active and well-known in her community. However, 10 years later, Globe Publishing Company, which is a tabloid company basically, comes along with the same photos and a fictional story about an elderly woman who had quit her paper route because she had become pregnant. So Mitchell's estate sues for false light and wins. Even though the story never mentioned Mitchell by name, the juxtaposition of the photos in which she was clearly identifiable had placed her in a false light. There have been a number of similar cases along the way that aren't mentioned in the book or mentioned on the website, and those could include things like a cab driver who had his picture taken for a newspaper article quite willingly, but then read the paper the next day and found that the caption illustrated an article, the photo was illustrating an article about crooked cabbies. There's another one of a lovely couple walking closely together in the park and obviously very much in love. Well, turns out, you know, the caption was a little bit off and these two people were married to two other people who did not appreciate the idea of their walk in the park and their being obviously in love. So it's important to understand in these kinds of cases that you have to accurately characterize the kind of person that is in a photo. You have to be very careful about the relationship between an illustration and the text here. There's other kinds of false light cases too. There's the Bobby Seale case where he objected to a characterization of a conversation he had with a Black Panther Party member, but the same Sullivan standard was applied to the Seale case. He was a public figure and actual malice was applied, and and there were possibly some errors in the docudrama, but as we've seen, those kinds of errors are permissible under a theory that says there has to be wide open and robust debate and elbow room for the First Amendment. And we saw that in the, for example, libel chapter that we were talking about last time. Another one, Cantrell versus Forest City Publishing Company, a reporter pretends to have an interview with the widow of a man killed in a West Virginia bridge collapse, and he had never actually bothered to interview her, and so the court said he'd acted with actual and put her in a false light. So this is very similar to libel. What you need to know about the false light standard is usually that it would have to satisfy the Sullivan test for actual malice. And if you remember that, then you're home free. Now, actual malice, remember, is knowingly publishing something false or reckless disregard for the truth. And I think that in the Cantrell versus Forest City case, the reckless disregard for the truth was pretty apparent there. Libel and false light are both legal theories that are designed to protect a person's right to a good reputation, and so too is the publication of private facts legal theory. Very much like false light, lawsuits over the publication of private facts also relate to a concern for the personal right of privacy. In this case, the private facts usually have to be pretty embarrassing. You know, just slipping on a banana peel or throwing away your chewing gum or not recycling is obviously not enough. But they don't have to involve illegal or moral issues. The publication of facts concerning a person's financial records, medical information, domestic difficulties, all these things have been held to be embarrassing enough to cause damages. Of course, lawsuits involving private facts can involve facts that have already been made private, usually. There is one 1931 case, kind of interesting, in which the facts were considered to be so embarrassing that the courts found for the plaintiff. This involved a lawsuit over the feminist film, The Red Kimono. The film was written and produced by Dorothy Davenport Reed, who was a well-known feminist filmmaker during the silent movie period. It presented the true story of a former prostitute named Gabrielle Darley who was charged with murder and found innocent. In 1918, Darley married a high society figure from St. Louis, a Mr. Bernard Melvin, and abandoned her old life, and it became part of her past. But when the Red Kimono movie came out in 1925, Reed advertised it as having been based on a true story, and she even named Gabrielle Darley. Well, Mrs. Melvin, formerly Gabrielle Darley, sued for $50,000 and won in a California court. The movie producers argued that all the facts of the case were true and available in open court records, but the court said that any person living a life of rectitude has a right to happiness, which includes freedom from unnecessary attacks on their character or social standing or reputation. This is exactly the kind of privacy law that Brandeis wanted to fend off the yellow press, but it is not the kind of privacy law that ended up evolving over time. In fact, only a few years later, in Sittis versus FR Publishing, the courts found in New York that a mathematical genius who had been in the public eye at age 16 when he graduated from Harvard was now working as a store clerk, and that his supposed genius had not brought him that much in life. Now, Sittis sued for invasion of privacy, but he lost because the federal appeals court said that the misfortunes and frailties of neighbors and public figures are the subjects of considerable interest and discussion to the rest of the population. So these two cases, Melvin and Sittis, are more or less coming out with different outcomes using the same legal theory. But the courts soon narrowed all of this down, and finally in Cox versus Cohn in 1975, the idea even of the identification of a rape victim by a Georgia broadcaster from information that had been lawfully obtained from public records wasn't an actual invasion of privacy because the records were public. It's worth noting here, of course, that any disclosure of the name of a victim of a crime has very serious ethical implications, especially rape victims or witnesses to crime or others that can be hurt by the disclosure. So it's very important for people in the media to be sure that they consult their editors or the ethical guidelines in places like the Society of Professional Journalists or the American Society of Newspaper Editors for better information about that. I'd like to mention two other very important cases in this area, the Howard versus Des Moines Register case and the Sippel versus Chronicle Publishing case. The Howard versus Des Moines Register case in 1979 involved a person who was identified as a victim of forced sterilization in a county medical facility. It was run for people who were feeble-minded. It was part of an old-style eugenics effort to help strengthen the human race, supposedly. But actually, Mrs. Howard was not all that feeble-minded, and she sued the Des Moines Register for invasion of privacy. The court said that it was a good example of investigative journalism, however, and the subject was one of grave public interest. And it's an example of the leeway that the courts allow legitimate news articles, so Mrs. Howard was not able to recover from the Des Moines Register. The case involving Oliver Sippel is another very important case in the area of privacy. In 1984, Sippel lost a lawsuit involving an incident that had happened in 1976. He had prevented the assassination of then-President Gerald Ford, and because some of the people in the local news media found it very interesting that he was also gay, his role as a gay activist, he had been a sort of a public gay person in San Francisco, became national news. Now the problem was that back home, and these are the days before a lot of really instant and widespread communication, back home his family really had no idea. And so after the incident in which he's saving the president's life and then outed as a gay person, his mother never speaks to him again, his brothers and sisters don't want to speak to him again. And remember, back in those days there was a lot of prejudice. So he sues the San Francisco Chronicle, and there were a couple of other newspapers involved here as well, for publication of private facts, and he loses because, obviously, he's newsworthy. And the court says there can be no privacy with respect to a matter which is already public or which has previously become part of the public domain. Once the information is released, unlike a physical object, it can't be recaptured and sealed. So, in other words, the cat's already out of the bag. But more importantly, this is such an important kind of newsworthy event that the newsworthy defense obviously is going to apply. Leaving the realm of the personal right and going into the realm of property rights, we talk about misappropriation and intrusion. Now, there's two major kinds of misappropriation. There's commercialization and there's right of publicity. Usually commercialization cases involve private people whose names or likenesses or other identifying characteristics are used without their permission. Whereas in the right of publicity, cases involve celebrities whose names and likenesses and songs and other identifying characteristics are used without their permission. In the one, the claim is that something has been taken away that's a personal property right, and in the other, the claim is that something has been taken away that's intrinsic to the public persona of a commercial or public person. One of the big commercialization cases is Polydoros versus 20th Century Fox, in which a character from a book that was turned into a movie called The Sandlot claimed that he was the fictional character that was portrayed in the movie. So in other words, Michael Polydoros, a childhood friend of the writer, sues because his fictional character is too close to his real character. But the court sided with the author, and they said it's generally understood that novels are written out of the background and experiences of a novelist, and the characters portrayed are fictional, but very often they grow out of real persons the author has met or observed. So in that case, the privacy rights of the person who was the basis of the character were not recognized by the courts. In terms of right of publicity, there's a couple of interesting cases here. One of them is Carson versus Here's Johnny, in which Johnny Carson, who was the host of The Tonight Show for years in the 1970s and 80s, sued a portable toilet manufacturer. The toilet manufacturer used his introductory slogan. Ed McMahon would come on and say, "Here's Johnny." And that was so identifiable, everybody knew about it, and the toilet manufacturer obviously is trying to capitalize on Carson's right of publicity. There are similar cases that have involved Bette Midler or Vanna White. I mean, even to the point where Vanna White could sue Samsung for using a robot that looked a lot like her and behaved a lot like she behaved on the set. So it's kind of interesting that way. The only big case that went to the Supreme Court was Zucchini versus Scripps Howard Broadcasting. And that was a case in which a TV station broadcast a human cannonball's entire act against his objections. And the Supreme Court said that it was not really newsworthy and that the broadcast had deprived Zucchini, the human cannonball, of the economic value of his performance. This ruling and some of the others are very similar to copyright rulings where partial excerpts for reviews might be permitted under fair use, but a complete reprinting or rebroadcasting of some of the material might be copyright infringement, which we'll find out more about later. Also in the area of property rights, there's the problem of intrusion. These cases usually involve news gathering and not reporting. So, for example, when hidden cameras or deception of some kind are involved, that could be an intrusion, sort of a case involving the media. To win an intrusion suit, a plaintiff has to prove that the media acted in a way that a reasonable person would find highly offensive. This is a pretty difficult area to define since there's often no absolute expectation of privacy. There have been a number of instances in which reporters have gone undercover to investigate matters of public interest that might have been very intrusive, starting with Nellie Bly's investigation of the women's asylum in 1888. That's one early example, and there have been a lot of others. But the cases involving intrusion recently also involve questions of the personal privacy of the people being reported on, and usually these are private people. Wilson versus Lane is a classic example. That's the case in 1999 that banned ride-alongs. It used to be that photographers would go along with police on arrests or when they executed search warrants. And there was an example when a Washington Post photographer accompanied police on a search of a private couple's house. They were looking for evidence that concerned his son, but the couple were subdued and handcuffed and treated the way police treat people who are criminals when they're breaking into their house. And so after photographing this more or less embarrassing situation, the Washington Post was sued for privacy and they lost the suit. And the Supreme Court said that the police probably couldn't have predicted the constitutional law in this area and it was complex and therefore they weren't really liable for damages. But they didn't want that kind of ride-along to take place in the future. And so the show Cops got a lot tamer as a result of the Wilson versus Lane case. There were other cases like this. Oftentimes they involve requests for injunctions. For example, Galella versus Onassis, where the former president's wife, Jackie Kennedy Onassis, obtained a court injunction against a New York photographer named Ron Galella and forced him to stay 25 feet away from her. And there have been lots of similar cases along those lines as well. So generally speaking, any person or thing that can be seen from a public vantage point can be used for news purposes by journalists and printed in newspapers or broadcast on TV with no legal problem. If there are people in the background of a news photo, they don't have a right to privacy in that sense. However, photos or video taken for commercial purposes or for cinema have to involve the consent of everyone who's identifiable. And this more or less wraps up our brief tour through privacy law. I think it's worth repeating here that there are four major privacy issues: false light, misappropriation, intrusion, and publication of private facts, and that the defenses against privacy lawsuits include newsworthiness, public record, and consent. And again, it's important to remember that what's legal is not always what's ethical, and what's ethical sometimes is not what's legal. The case of Cox versus Cohn or the Oliver Sipple case are examples where the identification of the person in connection with their personal lives was perfectly legal, and yet there were serious ethical issues that accompanied that identification. And sometimes trespass or intrusion in the public interest might be part of a journalist's responsibility. So this wraps up our introduction to privacy law. Thanks for your attention, and I will see you next time in Media Law and Ethics.